Welcome to episode 20 of Your Kids Next Read podcast, in which we talk about books and reading for kids of all ages. And thank you once again for those fantastic reviews and recommendations on Apple Podcast. It really helps us in the rankings, and we are so grateful for each and every one. I'm Alison Tate, author of middle grade adventure series, The Mapmaker Chronicles, The Adaban Cipher, and my latest, The Maven and Reeve Mystery Series. And I'm here with my co-host, the outstanding Megan Daly, celebrity teacher librarian, blogger at Children's Books Daily, and author of Raising Readers, How to Nurture a Child's Love of Books. Megan and I, along with our good friend, author Alison Rushby, are founders of the Your Kids Next Read community on Facebook. Search for Your Kids Next Read there to join us. So, Megan Daly, tell us all about the exciting times in the land of Megan this week.
I've had a bit of a late night last night. Yeah, I know, very late. No, I didn't get home till nearly midnight with my mother.
And did you turn into a pumpkin or what?
I nearly did. I nearly had a meltdown on her at 45. I can still have a meltdown with my mum because, you know, when you go and visit your family, you revert back to, like, your place in the family. And yeah. Mine is often to meltdown at my mum because she's my safe place and I'm like, just let it all hang out. But, no, I left work bang on the bell leaving yesterday afternoon. I finished my year three class and I was like, guys, I've got to go. I'm driving to the Gold Coast. And I went
in that voice. Like, did you actually use that
voice? I did. I was like, the bell rang. I was like, I've got to go. I'm out the door. And they were all cheering me on. It was quite cute. But I picked up my mum and we drove down to the Gold Coast in peak hour traffic, which was not fun. But we were going to see William Barton, who is an Indigenous musician, play in the HOTA, the Home of the Arts at the Gold Coast, which is astonishing. It is the most beautiful new development down at the Gold Coast, which, look, it doesn't rival Goma in Brisbane because, like, Goma is my happy place, but it is astonishing. And if you are Gold Coast or Brisbane based, get yourself along to HOTA. But we drove down there to see William Barton play in the exhibition of the William Robinson artwork. And William Robinson is a really well-known Queensland artist. He does amazing landscapes. And my mum went to art college many, many years ago when she left school. And William Robinson was her teacher. And so she learnt art from this now incredibly well-renowned artist. And it was just beautiful. The piece was called Lyrical Landscapes. And it was like 2 hours of just being immersed in artwork and music, Indigenous music. And it was, the piece went for the entire 2 hours. He had a number of different musicians playing with him and there was a choir. So it didn't stop. There was no break in the music and it just took you through this lyrical landscape. It was gorgeous. I just loved it. But it was a bit of a late night, Al, and I'm, you know, a little tired this morning.
Because midnight is a late night when you are 45 years old, right?
It is. I taught 6 library lessons in a row that day. I was tired. What about you? Have you been staying up till midnight?
I stay up till midnight or close to most nights, actually. Yeah. I'm kind of like that's my night. I'm a night owl. I always have been. But I'm just in awe of the fact that you have been out, A, drove a fair distance, B, sat in a gallery surrounded by people watching music and art for 2 hours and then drove home. Because I am just stuck in Groundhog Day. I am doing the same thing every single day at the moment. Although I took a little holiday yesterday. I took Procrasty Pup, my beautiful border collie, out to a local beach and just ran him up the beach for about an hour with a friend because you're allowed to have the one friend exercising date. So I did that and I have to say I'm going to do more of that, like actually make a bit more of an effort to make the most of the fact that I live in quite a large LGA, as they say, with a lot of beaches and bushwalks because – I just got to the point on Wednesday where I really hit the wall of boredom, and I'm finding that the general ennui of being stuck, you know, in the same thing every day, day in, day out, is really affecting my work and everything, because I had planned to actually, you know, write something new, and I was all set to get started this week, and I just feel a bit depleted. So
yeah.
I'm going to, you know, we talked, I think, last week about, you know, creative dates and things like that. And I think I just need to find ways to do that for myself a bit more often, because it, unfortunately, it looks as though I'm going to be doing my Groundhog Day for the next, you know, at least another 2 weeks, if not more. So I'm going to need to kind of find ways, you know, just to break through it, because otherwise – all I'm going to be doing is admin. Do you know what I did yesterday? I spent the day going through, and who does this? This is where I'm at. I need you all to understand where I'm at. I went through the video files on my computer, you know, in the photo app section, and deleted, like went through, looked at them all, you know, put titles on everything so I'd be able to find it again, and deleted the stuff that was repeats. That's what I did.
Could you do that to mine?
My Lord. Are you kidding me? I just, but it was actually strangely soothing. It was like one of those mindfulness kind of exercises, because I felt like I was doing something useful, but I wasn't really doing anything at all. Mm. Anyway, this is, you know, not books and
writing.
We live
in strange times.
We do. And I guess we all just have to find our own way through them. So currently mine will be, you know, organizing my files, because I never do that. But there were some bright spots in the week, because there was book mail. So what did you receive this week?
Oh, I got some very good book mail this week. First up, I got the new Kate DiCamillo, and it's an advanced reader copy, so it's not out until the end of September, but I'm talking about it today mainly because I wanted to insert it in before you inserted it.
I know, because I got it as well. And I couldn't believe it when it was there for you instead of for me. Anyway.
I know, I shoved it in really quickly. That was really mean of me, and I can't believe I'm admitting that.
Particularly as it's a magical medieval tale and right up my alley.
I felt it was appropriate. I talked about it.
No, you're right. You're right.
So it's called The Beatrice Prophecy. It's by Kate DiCamillo, and it's illustrated by Sophie Blackall, who are both creators I adore. Kate DiCamillo is she's just like astonishing. She is, everything she writes just, it makes me cry and it makes me happy all at once. And I was so fortunate a few years ago to have her come to one of my year six book club meetings. She happened to be in Australia, and Walker Books very kindly brought her along to one of my book club nights. So that was wonderful to have met her. But this one is a medieval tale, and it is a fantastical meditation on fate, love, and the power of words to spell the world. We shall all in the end be led to where we belong. It starts. We shall all in the end find our way home. In a time of war, a mysterious child appears at the monastery of the Order of the Chronicles of Sorrowing. Oh, you had me there, Kate. Beatrice, curled in a stall, racked with fever, coated in dirt and blood, and holding fast to the ear of Answellica, the recalcitrant goat. As the monk nurses Beatrice to health, he uncovers her dangerous secret, one that imperils them all. And so it is that a girl with a head full of stories must venture into a dark wood in search of the castle of a king who wishes her dead. But should she lose her way, Beatrice knows that those who love her,
a wild-eyed monk. He's not a wild-eared monk. You said a wild-eared monk.
I was looking at the cover and my notes. A wild-eyed monk. Sorry, Alison Tate. A man who had once been king. A boy with a terrible sword and a goat with a head as hard as stone will never give up searching for her. And to know this is to know everything. Now, I haven't read it, but I know that what Kate DiCamillo does absolutely beautifully is relationships and timeless themes. And I cannot wait to read this. I think it's aimed at readers from, I would say, 9 and to sort of 12 or 13, and adults. But it looks glorious, and it's got a beautiful front cover. Looking forward to that one. I also got in the mail this week Dragon Skin by Karen Foxley, who is, of course, the best-selling multi-award-winning author of Lenny's Book of Everything. And this one is a magical tale about a girl who saves a dragon and rescues her family. And again, I am aging this one from about 9+. And the blurb on the back says, how to save a dragon. Assemble equipment, water, Weet-Bix, sugar, syringe, sticky tape, scissors. Number two, believe in everything. Pip never wants to go home. She likes to sit at the waterhole at dusk and remember Micah, her best friend. At home, her mother's not the same since her boyfriend moved in. They don't laugh anymore, and Pip has to go to bed early, turn off her light, and pretend she doesn't exist. When she finds a half-dead creature at the waterhole, everything changes. She knows she has to save this small dragon and return it to where it comes from. But how? Again, I have not read this one, but I am so excited to read this book because I have loved and adored everything Karen Foxley has ever written. Mm. She, a bit like Kate DiCamillo, does heart and hope and vulnerability just so beautifully and gently. And her writing always just fills me with this feeling of warmth, and I really love everything she's ever written. And I'm actually going to be in conversation with Karen about her book Dragon Skin on Thursday the 7th of October at Riverbend Books in Brisbane.
And
it's that one, she's doing a few events that week at different bookstores around Brisbane. She's got another one with Sam Wheeler at Where the Wild Things Are. But this one that I'm speaking at is aimed at teacher librarians and parents mostly. And we're going to talk about why she writes the themes that she does and how she thinks her books are applicable in the school situation, and all things writing. So I'm really looking forward to that because I have spoken with Karen Foxley before, and she's one of those people that I really enjoy having a chat to. So that will be a very casual, but I hope insightful and educational little talk at Riverbend.
Sounds great.
Yeah, and then my final book this week is a change of direction from those two, which are going to be completely heartfelt stories, which will probably make me cry, to Listified by Andrew Petty. And this one is from the team at Britannica Books, and it looks like a Britannica volume. When it arrived in the mail, I was like so excited about it because there's nothing better than the Britannica Books logo sitting on your coffee table or your bookshop, as far as I'm concerned. It just fills me with like confidence that yes. It's an authoritative book. So I love a bit of a Britannica publication. And this one is really clever. They've done something a bit different. It's got more than 300 surprising and ingenious lists that will blow your mind. So, for example, I've got it open to page 46 and it's leftovers, 18 things that humans have left on the surface of the moon.
Oh.
Footprints, ashes. The ashes of American geologist Gene Shoemaker, who discovered many comets and planets. Didn't know that.
No.
A hammer has been left on the moon. A signed photograph of an astronaut. Two golf balls. 96 bags of astronauts' poo. So
what? 96 bags.
I know, right? Wow. Why don't they bring it back? Anyway, and then on page 78 in the nature section, 10 common types of clouds and how to spot them. So it's a really interesting, I think this one will really appeal to middle primary, upper primary readers who enjoy those sort of world record type books. This one is lists of different strange things, 24 distinctive hats and where they came from, all sorts of really interesting lists. It's just super interesting, little snippets of information, not a huge amount of information. You wouldn't be using this for a research task, but this is absolutely one for school library shelves and a really great giftable volume. And as I said, everybody loves a Britannica Books logo, so I think this is a must-have giftable one.
Fantastic. Well, I've also received some excellent book mail this week. So I have got four special editions for the Australia Reads, Australia Reads, what would you call it? campaign promotion.
Yes.
Australia Reads Special Editions. So they're really like sweet little books that were that are available through all booksellers. They're $4.99. There are four of them. The Deep End by Jenna Guillaume, which is a more of a YA. There's Little Book Big Universe, A Guide to Exploring Australia's Night Skies by Professor Lisa Harvey-Smith, illustrated by First Dog on the Moon, which is really, really cute. There's Little Legends, The Missing Cup by Nicole Hayes and Adrian Beck. And there's The Magnificent Hercules Quick by Ursula Dubosarski, illustrations by Andrew Joyner. So there's four of them that you can collect. They're special editions that are written especially for the Australia Reads campaign to celebrate the wonder and magic of reading. There's everything from laugh out loud funny to sort of the wistfulness of lost love. And they have been written and illustrated by some of Australia's most admired and generous authors. So you will find them at your favourite booksellers in store or online right now. And there are, if you go to australiareads.org.au and look at the special editions, there are activities and teacher's notes for each of them on the resources page as well. So I received all of those. And then I have a new book from Stephen Herrick, which is called How to Repaint a Life. It's a YA. It's just arrived like practically today. Last night, I think I picked it up. Isaac is running from his old life when he steps off the bus in a small town. He has nowhere to stay and doesn't plan on sticking around, but a local cafe owner's kindness offers him the chance to change his story. Then Isaac meets Sophie and learns he's not the only one wanting to repaint his life. So I think, you know, it sounds to me, I mean, Stephen Herrick does this sort of territory so incredibly well.
Yeah.
And I think that this one, the chapters are quite short. Sorry.
Verse novel? Not a verse novel?
No, it's not verse. It's okay. It's prose. The chapters are quite short, however, so it's kind of it looks, you know, as a YA novel, like there's a few pages in it. It's probably, there you go, 274 pages.
Okay.
But it's doesn't look it's accessible because the chapters are short. There's still quite a lot of white space around the text. And it just looks like something that I think a lot of YA lovers are just going to, you know, fall into in a big way.
I wonder if it's a companion book to his last one. It sounds very familiar. I just love Stephen Herrick's YA. Again, I cried in his last one. Oh, I sobbed. It was set in the Blue Mountains. That
one is that the Simple Gift?
Yeah. Oh no, it wasn't the Simple Gift.
All right. So Herrick says he was inspired. I'm reading the media release. Herrick says he was inspired to write How to Repaint a Life after being asked thoughtful student questions about The Simple Gift,
okay,
which is another of his, school visits over the years. I'm always surprised and excited to see how involved students are in that story, he says. I hope How to Repaint a Life works as an independent sister book to The Simple Gift, yet stands alone as a novel.
So maybe there you go. Daily. Big tick to you. Yes, it obviously was The Simple Gift.
Megan Daly, big tick. You just
I was just giving myself a pat on the back.
You
it
just
sound very familiar. So I will look forward to going back into that world because I really enjoyed that one. I love Stephen Herrick's YA stuff.
Okay, cool. All right, well, I'm looking forward to reading it. I haven't read The Simple Gift, so I'll read the sister book and we'll see if it stands alone. The other one I'm really looking forward to reading is this a new one that I received from Mala Nunn called Sugar Town Queens. And Mala Nunn is the CBCA shortlisted author of When the Ground is Hard, which was a YA sort of mystery novel set in a boarding school that was just like fantastic story and often recommended in sort of historical mystery, strangely enough, because I think it was set in the 90s or something, so that's historical now. And this one again is set in South Africa. 15-year-old Amandla's mother has always been strange. For starters, she's a white woman living in Sugartown, one of South Africa's infamous shanty towns. She won't tell anyone, not even Amandla, about her past, and she has visions, including one that promises the return of Amandla's father as if he were a prince in a fairy tale. But their hardscrabble life is no fairy tale. And then it sort of goes on and, you know, lately her mother has been acting even more strangely. So when Amandla finds a mysterious address at the bottom of her mother's purse, along with a large amount of cash, she decides it's finally time to get answers about her mother's life. With her best friends by her side, Amanda is ready to take on the devil himself. And as she confronts devastating family secrets and pain that has lasted a generation, taking on the devil is exactly what she must do. I think it sounds amazing. She does a brilliant job of kind of bringing that world to life. And so I'm really looking forward to diving into that. And I'm hoping to interview Mala for the So You Want to Be a Writer podcast as well. So I'm looking forward to that. So yeah, so that's it. That's all my book mail this week. But like lots of things for me to get into there this week. I might have just a creative date with a book.
That's I was just going to say, you are not going to be having Groundhog Day because you are going to be visiting very interesting places in a literary sense.
I am. All right, so let's move on to our bingo question this week. And this one is one that we do see a lot as well. I mean, that's what our bingo questions are. They are questions that come up a lot. And it's about introducing classics to kids. Like, you know, what are some great classics to introduce for children? How do I introduce my child to the classics? When should I introduce my child to the classics? Those kinds of questions. And it's an interesting one because I think there's a few things that we need to remember when we introduce classics for kids. And one of them is that they don't always translate well. And by that, I mean something that you might remember reading when you were a kid, you know, 30 years ago, or something that your grand, you know, your mother or your grandparents might have enjoyed 100 years ago, doesn't always work for kids today. And it's an interesting thing to see which ones do and which ones don't. So as an example, we read, I sort of started reading, you know, the classics or introducing the classics to my boys, you know, fairly young. We read White Fang and Call of the Wild by Jack London, which are classics by anyone's standards.
Absolutely.
And they went down a treat. They really enjoyed them. So I think I read Call of the Wild to Book Boy when he was younger, like maybe 7, and then he read White Fang himself, and he enjoyed those because those, I don't know if you've, how long it's been since you read those books, but they are just rip-roaring adventures from the perspective of dogs and wolves.
I read
and,
them quite a lot
yeah.
because I study them in schools still.
Oh, of course. Oh, do they? Okay, there you go. Yeah, so we really enjoyed those. Then we also, because it was in, I think, the Scholastic Book Club, we picked up an edition of Around the World in 80 Days, which does not work that well.
I agree.
We read that. And the part of the reason it doesn't work so well is it was written in a time when no one had been anywhere. And so everything is described. Everything is described in this intense detail. And whereas, you know, even sort of like, I think, you know, Book Boy was probably again 7 or 8 when we were reading it. He knew enough about what places were like, having seen them on the internet, to not need, you know, in-depth description of them. And so that didn't work so well. Robinson Crusoe also, you know, just really didn't work that well for us. But what did work well was Sherlock Holmes, A Study in Scarlet, which, you know, is definitely like an adult classic, but he read that himself when he was about 7 or 8 because he was really interested in mystery stories. And my mother said, why don't you try him on this? And I was like, wait a minute. And she goes, yeah, but, you know, a murder story written at that time is really different to
Absolutely.
A murder story written now. And, you know, there's no detail. And then there's just this intensely clever deduction stuff, which he absolutely loved. And then, you know, things like he picked up oh, no, I gave it to him. I gave him The Outsiders when he was about 12 by S.E. Hinton, which I consider a classic. It's over 50 years old now. Loved it. And Book Boy Jr. has actually just picked that up himself at 14 off the bookshelf and he's reading that and really enjoying it. Book Boy also loved Fahrenheit 451 by Ray Bradbury. And he absolutely loved, and this was given to him by a friend, not by me, because I've always hated it, but he loved it, and that was The Catcher in the Rye by J.D. Salinger. So I guess, you know, they don't always translate well, and this is the thing I find with classics too, is that, I think you come to them at the time that you're ready for them. I think that, and when your friends, if you are a reader as well, your friends are also recommending things to you, and you get to a point where you want to have read things so that you can talk about them with other people who have read them. But that is generally for me more of a mid-teen up sort of a thing. Because, the thing with the classics too is that the language can be very old-fashioned. Like there's a lot more description, there's a lot less action. They can feel very dense and very wordy. And I understand that we do want to challenge our kids and we do want them to read different styles of text. I get that. And I think that's really important as well. But I think it's important that they are ready to do that because otherwise it is going to feel like a school project and they will never come back to them. I mean, you only have to remember, books that you studied for school that you
Became mutiny.
just be oh they just become such a chore and you will never ever go back to them. And my great example of this is I read Pride and Prejudice in year 10 for school, fine, and then I had to study Emma for my HSC and it pretty much derailed my Austen journey for years and years and years. It took me a long time to come back to Austen after Emma, because I just could not stand it. And I don't know if it was the stress of the HSC or the I didn't love the character, but I didn't go back there for a long time. So I think you also need to think about why you want kids to read them. Like, what is it that you're hoping, is going to happen here? Do you agree with that?
Absolutely. And look, I come at, I guess, from a bit of a teacher perspective as well. Why do we want children to read the classics? I would say one of the reasons we want them to read the classics is so that they have a broad understanding of the stories in, as little detail as is needed for the situation. But things like I recently saw West Side Story as a musical at QPAC, and it's a very much Romeo and Juliet story, and we are doing fairy tales and fables in year one at the moment. And a lot of those fairy tales and fables, the year ones are making connections and they're going, oh, that's a bit like a modern book that they're now reading. We want them, it's the same reason we often want our children to understand the Bible stories or myths and legends, because those stories are retold in various forms over the years, and it's often a lot of modern movies are based on Austen theme, Austen-esque themes. So we want them to have a broad understanding of the classics. But I agree, you have to come at them when you are ready. My 13-year-old daughter has recently started reading Anne of Green Gables, and she came at that because of the series, I think the Netflix series Anne with an E, which Alison Rushby actually put me onto, and we started. I thought that would be a fabulous thing to watch in one lot of school holidays with my daughters, and we sat down to watch it, and I turned, and my then I think she was just turned 9-year-old was sobbing. She was terrified by Anne with an E. Thank you, Alison Rushby. Realized it wasn't at all appropriate for her. But my 13-year-old and I did continue watching Anne with an E, and she's gone on to read the Anne of Green Gables books because she wanted more, I think probably of Gilbert. But
Well, we
often
all wanted more of Gilbert, didn't we?
didn't we? But I think that for this generation of kids, watching the movie first or the television series first can give a nice overview of the stories because, like you said, the language is old-fashioned. The stories are quite complex. Kids of today do not have necessarily an understanding of the setting, of the context of the story. And so when they see it visually, and we usually would say, you have to read the book before you watch the movie. But I actually don't. I don't bang on about that as a teacher librarian because I think seeing the movie first can give a bit of a visual context for the book. So I'm a big fan of that. Like you said, and I don't necessarily think the language is accessible for contemporary readers, but that doesn't mean we shouldn't have a go at it. Classics that have worked really well in my house have been Anne of Green Gables, Little Women, The Secret Garden, and Moby Dick. And the reason those books have worked well is that we listened to Little Women on a very, very long drive once upon a time, and the audio version of the book was absolutely beautiful. And I know that we all just fell into the story, and I think we were having a lovely long drive, and it just really was the right time, and it was a perfect reading. So it was a great way to introduce them to Little Women. And they have then gone on to read the graphic novels, which are by Kathleen Gross, and they are really contemporary retellings of Little Women. It's the first one, that one that I'm looking at the moment, is called An Adaptation of Little Women, sort of. And it's a bit of a contemporary retelling of Little Women. So graphic novels can be a great introduction to the classics. And again, like watching the television or the movie series of the classics, it gives a good overview of the story with less of the dense language. So Maria Marsden has done two excellent graphic novel adaptations. She has done Anne of Green Gables, and she has also done The Secret Garden. And I would highly recommend those for readers from 9 plus, but of course they're classics, so anybody can really read them. And then the other thing I really love is a classic which is turned on its head a bit. So Patrick Ness did a beautiful pictorial, but like a picture book for older readers, of Moby Dick. It's called And the Ocean Was Our Sky, and it's illustrated by Ravina Kai, and it turns the story of Moby Dick upside down, and it tells it from the perspective of the whales. And it's this really haunting tale of power and obsession. It's quite gruesome and it's quite visual, so definitely one for readers from, say, I would say 10 plus, even 11 plus. But I love these different versions of the tellings of the classics, because from my point of view, what I want my children and what I want my students to gain from the classics is the overview of the story. I think, like we said right back at the beginning, I think the language can be quite tricky for contemporary children, but I think the story is what is important.
I think also choosing carefully what you choose to give them, as far as like looking at what they like to read now and looking for classics that hit those notes, because, you know, you're looking for the kinds of things that they want to read. Look for friendship, look for family, look for those sorts of things. But also, and this is something I've always recommend with classics, and this is something I've always done with my own boys, is we discuss the context. We discuss the point in history that they were written and the point in history that they, and I mean, when I say discuss, I don't mean I give them a lecture. I just give them a bit of an idea of where this author was, what the state of the world was, because classics can also be, like some of those classic stories, when you talk about power and imbalance and all of those sorts of things, you know, with regards to Moby Dick, they are a very set in a very particular social context a lot of the time, and it's really important that kids understand that, because those social contexts and social mores don't always work for modern kids. Modern kids will be reading it going, what?
Absolutely.
and so there needs to be some context of the fact that a lot of these are historical. Like, let's face it, yes, they're classics, but they are also historical. And so if you give them a bit of an idea about the kind of historical context, like even with The Outsiders, Bookbo and I will have a talk about the, you know, Essie Hinton wrote it when she was 17. This is the world she was living in. This is what it was all about, because it's important that you have an understanding of that when you're reading, you know, stories, you know, from the past, I think.
Couldn't agree more.
All right. Well, moving right along, we are going to our quick tips, Megan. What are your quick tips for this week?
Okay, well, a while ago, the lovely Lana Hallows wrote a post for me. She has been doing some work on my website for a few years on and off, and she just said to me one day, hey, I just actually want to know what you do as a teacher librarian. She has got two sons who are quite young, and she was like, I don't really know what they do at school all day, and I certainly don't know what they are doing in the library. And I was like, oh, that is such, sometimes you are so in your own bubble of reality and you assume everybody is understanding what you do, but you know, you don't. I'm talking in my own echo chamber, aren't I, of other teacher librarians and people who know my industry. So I thought it was a really good idea. And I want to share with you the five things that I shared with her in this blog post, which I will link in the show notes, about the five things that I wanted you to know about school libraries and school library staff. And the first one was that we see your child. And I think good library staff will always get to know their students, including their quirks and their special interests, And even the fact that they like to hold a book up high to hide their face when they are reading. Or the other day, I had this gorgeous kid the other day, and she's done it to me a few times. I've encouraged her to read a particular book in the library, and she would be a self-declared reluctant reader. And she's tried to slink out of the library twice on me now at lunchtime. And like, I don't care. She wants to go climb a tree, go climb a tree. But she's come in because she likes me. But then she starts reading a book and she's like, oh, it's just not my thing. I just want to go. But I'm just happy she's in there. But she slunk out of the library holding the book in front of her face. And I'm like, sweet pea, I can see you.
That book has legs.
But, you know, we get to know your children really well. The library is a safe place for a lot of kids. And, you know, it's a wonderful place at lunchtime, and we do get to know your children. So never assume that, you know, the teach librarian and the library staff don't know who your children are, even if they are the more reluctant readers. Number two, library class is not how you and I remember it. When I was at school, I actually had a great experience of a teacher librarian at school. And hilariously, my teacher librarian from St. Peter's Lutheran College is still at St. Peter's Lutheran College. And I have just gone back to work with her now. Hello, Mrs. Lewis. And so Jan Lewis from St. Peter's. And I actually had a fantastic experience of a teacher librarian at school. But I know a lot of people didn't necessarily, and it was a place of quiet and of study. But these days, library lessons are planned cooperatively with classroom teachers. They're a mix of learning about research skills and book conventions and literary goodness. We use lots of technology. We have got lots of makerspace type equipment in libraries. And library lessons are not quiet. I mean, clearly my library was never going to be quiet, but you know, I would say most libraries are not quiet these days. Number three is that school library staff see every child as a reader. And we, of course, have got those kids who would self-identify as reluctant readers or who read differently to other children because of diagnosed literacy issues or whatever that may be, or they may read by ear with audiobooks. But every child deserves to develop an identity as a reader, and we see every child as a reader. So that's, I think, really, really important. Mm-hmm. Just like we want to develop our own style with clothes, we can all develop our own identity as a reader, and that's going to look different for everyone, but every kid is a reader. Number four, it's not about the overdues. Oh, my glory. I personally could not care less about your overdues or if you have forgotten your library bag. I just want you to take books home. So, you know, whilst we're not going to lend you another 8 books if you've already got 12 books out in your name, teacher librarians and library staff in contemporary school libraries are less concerned about the overdues and more concerned about getting books in hands. Now, let me qualify that by saying I work at a well-resourced library. If you have a child in a school which is underfunded and under-resourced and understaffed, there is every likelihood that the overdues are going to be a very big deal because they probably only have one copy of Ando Weirdo and it has 12 reservations on it. But on the whole, we are less concerned about the overdues and we tend to not be dragons about the overdues. And the last one is that school libraries are learning hubs. They are not just places for quiet reading. They are places for creativity, learning, researching, exploring technology, and having ideas come together. And contemporary school libraries can be and should be the hub of the primary school, where all members of the school community come to access print and digital resources, attend meetings, and simply hang out because it's just a great place to be. So I really enjoyed putting together being interviewed by Lana for that blog post, and I will link it in the show notes because it, you know, like I said, I think everybody knows what I do, but they probably don't.
No, they don't. Mind you, the people who listen to our podcast will have a much clearer idea than most of what you do because we do discuss it.
I think it's important to share. This is why I guess I started my website so many years ago and why we would love you to share things like our podcast, because we're already speaking to the converted. If you're listening to this, you already love libraries and love books and love reading. But, you know, share this with your family start the conversation about the importance of school libraries and of reading.
Mm, definitely. And speaking of which, I have got this week three top tips to keep your tween interested in reading. And these are based on a post that I wrote for beafunmum.com around the time that the Firestar came out last year, because I was sort of like, you know, just getting in touch with my parenting blogger friends and saying, look, I'm, you know, I'm available. What would you like me to do? And she came back to me and said, oh, my tween's reading has fallen off a cliff. You know, how do I get her interested again? And so I came up with these three tips because I write middle grade novels because I love the age group. I love, you know, 9 to 13, you know, they're bright, they're funny, they're curious. They're also sophisticated, you know, in a funny kid way. They kind of fall between being 4 and 24, right, depending on the time of day, I think. And the great thing about them is that they will go with you into the unknown on any adventure that you care to write, as long as you give them a good reason to accompany you. You know, like they're up for it. They're still into it. They're not so cool that they're just like, yeah, nah, I'm too busy. I'll be over here if you want me. And they're also, you know, for me, they're on the verge of the greatest adventure that we all go through, which is surviving their teen years and growing up. Like, it is the biggest adventure, or one of the biggest adventures we go on. So I write books like The Firestar, like The Mapmaker Chronicles, like The Adaban Cipher, and I try to keep the pace fast and the action up and the humor present and the characters, you know, relatable. And I'm focusing on friendship and puzzles and twists and turns and the things that I loved in stories at that age, and you know, which frankly I still do. But I also know, as a parent of a 14-year-old, that it is incredibly difficult to get them to sit down and start reading, because this is when their social lives get busy. This is when what their friends think matters more than anything that you or I are ever going to say. This is when their mobiles begin to rule their lives, unless we teach them how to manage it, and reading can just take a back seat. But all is not lost. I have some tips on how to kind of just keep them on the reading train until they get through this period of their lives where they're so sort of, you know, fragmented. So my first tip is like anything. It's like writing. It's like anything. You have to make time for it. I am a great believer in routine. You know, you will never find time to write a book. You have to make time to write a book. And it's exactly the same with reading. So even, you know, as your kids get older, even if they were, you know, madly voracious readers, they kind of pull away from it because the phone can be, or the social aspect can be, such a big pull. So we make time for it. So my youngest son, Book Boy, would much rather run than read, and we have massive fights over screen time. Like, honestly, it's like a joke within all my family. You know, does he still have his phone today? No, he does not, because I've taken it off him. But we have a deal. You know, he reads for 20 minutes each night in bed, like sacred reading time. Before he goes to sleep, he reads his book. And, you know, he's currently reading The Outsiders. And, you know, I think he actually probably like secretly quite likes it. But I, you know, in the sense of having that space to read the book and wind down, but he would never tell me that. So I won't hold my breath. The second tip is not to pigeonhole them. And I know what you're thinking. You know, you would never censor your kids reading, but I think we are all guilty of it, even on a subconscious Absolutely. Level. And I know this because I was incredibly surprised when that same child that has to be, you know, forced into bed with a book arrived home from school last year with a verse novel. It is not a book I would ever have chosen for him. And I honestly, you can imagine, can't you, the number of books I throw at that child. But I just never, ever thought, I never put him and poetry together. And I should have, because he loves rap music. You know, I just, for him, did not make that connection. But he loved that book, borrowed several more by the same author. So we have to kind of let them read things. Let them read books you think that are too hard for them. Let them read books that you're worried that they might not be ready for. They'll put it down if they don't want it. Let them read adult books if they are, you know, on that cusp. Because we see a lot of this in the Your Kids Next Read group of, you know, he wants to read, he's 13, he wants to read Stephen King. You know, can you think of anything that's more child friendly? You know what? Let the kid read the Stephen King. He will not go any further than he is comfortable with.
No.
And, you know, personally, I think Stephen King is a godsend for 14-year-old boys, because Matthew Riley, same, you know, when they're looking for something that's a bit more sort of, they're a lot more grown up, I think, than we want them to be, and particularly with the oldest kid, right? That's the hardest one.
I had a similar situation this week, because one of my 13-year-old's friends, we were talking about the fact that I'd seen the Boy Swallows Universe play, and I loved it, but I found it quite confronting in terms of the domestic violence. And she's like, yeah, I found the book a bit confronting. I was like, wow, you've read Boy Swallows Universe? And she's like, yeah, it's like the best book I read this year. It's like, right. And I wouldn't have given that to a 13-year-old, but like, she read it and loved it. Says it's the best book she's read all year.
Yeah, I've had a few books like that with Book Boy, particularly because he was reading at such a much higher level than his age. And there were a few that I was worried about from that perspective. But, you know, in the end, the only one I put my foot down at, and I don't think he's read to this day, was Game of Thrones. That was the only book or series that I said no. But everything else, he's just, you know, he went through a full-on Stephen King phase at about the age of 13. Like, it just, I just think if they're readers and they want to go down that road, you have to at least allow them to take footsteps down the path. They will come back if they're not ready, and they do. You know, they'll be picking up Wimpy Kid as a bit of a respite before you know it. and then my third tip is to get some help, because finding the right book is the key to engaging kids of any age in reading, and particularly this age. So you need to basically ask for help. Ask in the Your Kids Next Read Facebook community on Facebook, obviously. Ask your school librarian. Ask your public librarian if children's specialists. Ask at the bookshop if there's a children's specialist at the bookshop, or, you know, anyone at the bookshop. Just go in and say, they will ask you the kinds of things that your child likes to do, the kinds of things that your child likes to read, and they will make suggestions. And they might suggest things that you have never heard of, and that is okay. Go with it, because you just don't know what is going to be the book that is going to kind of unlock that key for you. So I think, you know, I mean, one of the reasons that we started the Your Kids Next Read Facebook community was because I was trying to manage a 12-year-old boy who had read his way through the entire school library, moved on to Stephen King, and then I've got a 9-year-old who wouldn't move past Wimpy Kid. And so I contacted Megan and said, I think we're going to we need to find some help here. So those are my three tips. But yeah, like, it's worth the effort, and you might feel like you're getting nowhere. Like, you might be bringing books home from the library or buying books and handing them to them, and they're stacking up in their room, and then, you know, one day you'll walk past and they'll be there reading something that you would not necessarily have expected them to have been reading, and that's when you just tiptoe quietly away and leave them to it.
Fantastic. Love it.
All right. That's us done for the week. You can, of course, find all the show notes of all the books that we've mentioned and any blog post links we might have discussed at yourkidsnextread.com. And you will, of course, always find us in the Your Kids Next Read Facebook community doing what we do best. But what will we be doing for the week ahead, Megan? What are you up to?
Well, the beekeeper is finished. His 6 weeks of trips between Brisbane and Victoria with COVID tests every few days. So he's finished. Now, in days gone by, he used to celebrate quite heartily with nights out and lots of fun. We have four children, so it looks a bit different these days. So we are all going out on Saturday night to a fairly high-end Italian restaurant here in Brisbane. I feel quite nervous about it. He has insisted all of the kids have got new clothes. We're all going fancy.
Oh, fancy.
Fancy. Yep, boys have got their little their shirts and their ties. They're excited. He said the girls, you know, you don't have to wear dresses, girls, but, you know, maybe we could just get out of jeans and a hoodie. And we are going to a nice restaurant because we love eating out and we want the kids to go down that path. My girls are older and are very used to eating out. We're going to see how the five-year-old goes sitting at the high-end Italian restaurant. We have an exit strategy if need. But, yeah, so celebrations for the end of almond pollination season involve food and a fancy clothes.
That sounds excellent. Well, I will be going through every file on my computer, deleting what I don't need so I can get ready for the new one, because that's what we do down here on a Saturday night. Oh, how's my life? All right. It's been absolutely lovely chatting to you again, Megan Daly, and I will see you next time.
See you on the flip side. Bye.